I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. When we look back at the theologians who helped shape America in the 20th century, no litany can be complete, or even get started, without mentioning Reinhold Niebuhr. Known by some as America's conscience, he was a major participant in helping to define how we as a country defined the social gospel, how we attacked various issues in our society that worked against equality, parity, and democracy. Recently, PBS aired the program An American Conscience, The Reinhold Niebuhr Story. Perhaps you saw it on our sister station, WGVU-TV. In case you didn't, I hope you're able to catch it online at pbs.org. One of the show's participants is Reverend Gary Dorian. Aside from commenting on the works of Niebuhr in the film, he also wrote a very thought-provoking piece on religiondispatches.org entitled Irony Repeats Itself, Reconsidering Reinhold Niebuhr in the Trump Era. We thought that the program and the essay complement one another quite well, so we've asked Reverend Dorian to join us today to talk about both. A bit about our guest. Reverend Gary Dorian teaches at Union Theological Seminary and Columbia University. He is an Episcopal priest. His many books include, most recently, Kantian Reason and Hegelian Spirit, The Idealistic Logic of Modern Theology, which won the Association of American Publishers Prose Award in 2013, and The New Abolition, W.E.B. Du Bois and the Black Social Gospel. We welcome to Common Threads, Reverend Gary Dorian. Hello, Gary.
Hello, Fred.
Why don't we start from the very beginning in case people are not familiar with Reinhold. Just exactly who was he?
Well, he was one of the two or three most influential American theologians of the 20th century. He was a product of the social gospel movement, and he doesn't exist without it. He was a pastor in Detroit for 11 years before he came and to teach social ethics at Union Theological Seminary, and then he had an enormously influential career as a critic, as a writer of books that helped to shape the field, and as someone who reacted to all the sort of colossal world-shattering events of the 20th century. I mean, he lives between two world wars and responds to the Depression and then has a role to play in the Cold War as well. So he is someone who had a great deal of influence in simply setting the terms by which we talked about these great events in 20th century Christianity.
For someone who changed his positions so many times, how was he taken seriously? And what I'm going to do, Gary, is read from your piece. I'm just going to read a brief paragraph to give people the sense of just exactly the many camps that Reinhold Niebuhr found himself in. You write, Niebuhr attained fame by blasting the moral idealism of liberal Protestant church leaders. In the 1920s, he chafed at social gospel idealism while calling for more of it, not knowing what else to say. In the 1930s, he urged church leaders to throw off their moralism to join the class struggle against a dying capitalist order. In the 1940s, he urged church leaders to throw off their moralism to support the armed struggle against fascism. In the 1950s, he urged them to throw off their moralism to support America's Cold War against communism. In every case, it mattered that there was a powerful, ecumenical, culturally dominant Protestant establishment to criticize. Niebuhr took for granted that liberal Protestantism had immense cultural influence, and it was his group. Otherwise, his ferocious criticism of it would not have mattered. So let's talk about those, as I say, those various camps he found himself in and how he moved between one and the other and how he maintained his credibility.
Yes. Well, firstly, I think in the previous paragraph, I actually took you through the whole zig and zag in one long paragraph. It was, I think, maybe even one long sentence, which sort of, people sort of got the sense of, yes, indeed, how many different positions he held politically, because politically, Niebuhr changed his politics in some very significant way almost every decade, and certainly within every decade of his whole career. You'd get a major zig and zag going. And this is someone whose politics were, you know, steering the boat. It took him, he's not until about 1940 that he's really settled upon his theology. So that becomes an anchor for him when he finally settles sort of what it is. But long before that and then long after it, there's this zig and zag of the politics, and Niebuhr was very political. So all of that is just always in place, even talking about Niebuhr in any way, to generalize him about it at all, you almost always have to end up coming back and saying, well, which one are we talking about here? You know, which decade? What is he responding to? Because there are so many Niebuhrs out there, that is, people who sort of pick their favorite one and go for that. But that paragraph you read does at least, because of my refrain about throwing off your moralism, there's something showing there about what is continuous. That is, even while Niebuhr changes his position so often, he's always concerned to be realistic by his lights. He's always concerned that his group, that is, liberal Protestantism, is just too idealistic and too moralistic in the way that it approaches the world and thinks about it and preaches the gospel, and the gospel ends up becoming a just very idealistic, moralistic sort of social gospel understanding. So even though that is his group, and this is the other important thing, people who don't get this just think that Niebuhr is this severe critic of liberal Protestantism from somewhere else, but the criticism is so severe, and without even really being reflective about it, because that is his group. I mean, Niebuhr has no position whatsoever. He wouldn't be teaching at Union, you know, if he weren't a liberal Protestant product of the social gospel. So all of that is always going on with Niebuhr, and then it's just a question of, you know, talking about, okay, where are we right now? It's the Niebuhr. Are we talking about the Niebuhr of the 20s or the 30s or the 40s or the 50s or the 60s?
And I get the impression from your essay and from the TV program that being Niebuhrian, is that the right way to say
yeah.
it? Being a Niebuhrian was a challenging thing because it seemed like he was always disappointing people who were in his camp, because then he would take the completely opposite point of view. For instance, talk about his journey from pacifism to not pacifism.
Yes, in the film they have David Brooks comment on this, and rather puckishly, David says, "You know, when you change camps, when you go from one to the other, you would think that the new people are going to welcome you, but no, that's not how it works. The people you just broke from, they hate you for, you know, showing them up, and the new people, they hate you even more because they're not sure they trust you." Niebuhr did have to deal with a fair amount of that. His close friend, June Bingham, who wrote one of the first biographies of Niebuhr, she titled it Courage to Change, because to her that was the key to Niebuhr, you know, that he does have this courage to change his positions. And certainly a major one that's as fundamental as any other, is the fact that Niebuhr is typical of so much of liberal Protestantism of the 1920s. He had this whole generation of ministers who preached pro-war sermons in 1917 and 1918, and then after the war turned out badly and the peace had nothing whatsoever to do with Woodrow Wilson's 14 points or making the world safe for democracy or anything like that. It was just strictly the vengeance of the victors. And a terrible situation that sort of imposed upon Germany that sows the seeds of the next war. They can see this coming. These ministers who preached those pro-war sermons were just appalled and repentant for preaching sermons that they felt, you know, had just been falsified by at Versailles. So we have this whole generational tidal wave of people like Georgia Harkness and the great preacher Harry Emerson Fosdick and so many others. So many of them took that Sherwood Eddy tour to the war camps, and they came home and said, "I am a pacifist. I am never going to preach another pro-war sermon. I hope I can stick to that." And Niebuhr is one of them. This is back when, you know, he was a pastor in Detroit at this time, and he writes in his diary in a book that was later published as under the title "Leaves from the Notebook of a Tamed Cynic." He says, "I am done with the war business. I hope I can stick to that. I hope I can keep to that vow that I am done with it." And so for 10 years, you know, he did. He not only clung to a kind of anti-war idealism, but he did it so with such energy and brilliance, he ended up becoming the president of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, you know, the leading Christian pacifist organization. So he's really trying to stick to it, live it out, and bringing others to it all through the 1920s. So when Niebuhr ends up turning away from that and just saying, no, that too is a distortion, it's, you know, it's running with something that's just too simplistic, and yes, it's moralistic, that I have to let go of the moralism that is in me in order to make the gospel make sense in a world of conflict and where you can't just opt out from the struggle for power. That is his biggest turn of all. And he writes an essay in 1934 called "Why I Leave the FOR." And it's one of the classics of Christian social ethics. It's just one of those texts that if you're anywhere near this subject, you have to, you know, deal with it, because he's laying out his reasons why he's going to break from the very thing that he had said so passionately all through the 1920s.
That's interesting, because you say he has this epiphany in 1934, which is a few years before World War II, and one can see the logic of an evolution of thought from pacifism to just war when we're attacked by Japan and when we enter the war, when we enter the war with Germany as well. But what's happening in 1934 that encourages him to make that move?
Well, yes, there are some really key things to take apart there, because often people do kind of run with an impression about this. It's like, oh, he's seeing Nazi Germany on the rise, and he's, you know, determined to fight against it. That is how this story turned out, but that was not what he was thinking at all in the early 1930s. The announcement in 1934 that he's leaving, it's a classic text, but actually the announcement itself is coming for a couple of years. I mean, the major text, the greatest book Niebuhr ever wrote, was in 1932. It's called "Moral Man and Immoral Society," and it made the argument that is the crucial Niebuhr social ethical argument that informs all of his work. And so the argument for why he's going to have to give up being a pacifist is there in that book. And it is part and parcel of his concern to say that we need to move, that his group, liberal Protestantism, needs to move to the left politically, and he says rather vaguely to the right theologically. He has very little idea what he really means by the latter in the early 1930s. What he does mean on the political side is he has become not just a socialist, because he was a socialist before. I mean, he's already friends with Norman Thomas and running for the Socialist Party in 1928, 1929, so he was already a socialist. But now he's moving into a much more sort of hard-edged, power-oriented, we have to take responsibility for the violence that's required in order to gain power and make social gains and then defend those gains. And all of that is driving him to a much more sort of power-oriented analysis in which he's arguing that, you know, violence is just intrinsic to politics. You can't have any kind of a politics that gains or secures anything that doesn't have violence as a means to any end that you're seeking. And that being the case, it's just all these liberal sermons where people are saying, oh, we need to be like Gandhi, and Jesus was like Gandhi, and so on. The very sermons he gave in the 1920s, he's saying we have to stop that. It isn't true. And it's a way of kind of making the gospel itself kind of superficial, reducing it to a kind of moralistic idealism. So it's in the name of an actually quite hard-line left-wing neo-Marxist socialism that Niebuhr is repudiating pacifism in the early 30s. Now, but being on that trajectory does take you to the Niebuhr of 1940, in which he's pleading with Americans to face up to entering World War II and coming to the aid of poor, beleaguered Britain, which, of course, in 1940-41, England is just holding on by themselves against the Nazis. The rest of Europe is rolled over. And Niebuhr has an English wife by then, and he has lots of friends in the Labour Party in England, and he's something of an Anglophile himself. So his own just deep admiration and just love of the Brits for holding on against Hitler by themselves, that they come through in some of these classic writings he wrote in 40 and 41, especially an essay called On the Triumph of an Intolerable Tyranny, trying to marshal his country to fight in the war.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Reverend Gary Dorian, and we're talking about his essay, Irony Repeats Itself, Reconsidering Reinhold Niebuhr in the Trump Era. You know, that description that you mentioned, or that he encouraged liberal Protestantism to go to the left politically and to the right theologically, that did stick out, and I had to scratch my head. You're saying that it was vague, and can you put any more flesh on those bones?
Oh, sure. Well, the driving all of this, I mean, Niebuhr is a social gospeler. You know, he's from the beginning of his career. I mean, he went to Yale Divinity School. I mean, if you back further up, his father was an evangelical and reformed pastor. He grew up in the Midwest. So he grew up with a fairly typical Midwest evangelical Protestant background, tinged with the social gospel, then goes for his training at Yale Divinity School, where he heard it a lot, and he's a full-fledged social gospel liberal by the time he came out of seminary and started as a pastor in Detroit. And there, I mean, the key to the social gospel is the idea that the church has a mission to transform the structures of society in the direction of social justice. You know, no church had said that before the mid-1880s. But with the social gospel movement, you've got a whole language about social structure and that there's such a thing as social justice, and the church needs to be involved in creating structures of social justice. And Niebuhr is fully a product of that whole movement that enlisted the church in struggles for peace and justice. And, of course, that's the whole basis of his career. Once he gets to Union, teaching social ethics, that's what that field is all about. I mean, his field, social ethics, had no history or basis whatsoever except, you know, apart from the social gospel. So Niebuhr takes that for granted his whole career. People who want to read him as later becoming conservative in some ways that repudiates the social gospel, or people who just read, take too literally his blasting away at the idealism and moralism in the social gospel, and who think then he therefore became something else, it's just not true. I mean, the questions, the issues, the defining orientation of social gospel Protestantism, that defines Niebuhr's entire career. He never took any of that for granted or in question. The issue is, what does it mean? What kinds of movements do you have to be involved in to actually get social justice? Because his concern is that liberal Protestantism just becomes so moralistic, so idealistic, that it actually doesn't do any real good in society in order to, you know, make a better world, that it's just too naive and idealistic. So that critique is always going on the one side. On the other, so far as the theology goes, yeah, a certain kind of romanticized idealism and moralism that's in the social gospel theologically ends up producing bad politics. That's the argument. So he needs to rethink what he thinks theologically. Once he has come to a point where he's very critical of how the social gospel lives itself out in political movements and in social movements and the like, that does push him to the theological question of just, well, if something's gone wrong in the social ethics, well, what is it that's wrong in the theology that helped to produce that result? You know, that's his question. And he's got a brother who's pushing him pretty hard to put the question in just that way. Because his brother, another brilliant theologian, H. Richard Niebuhr, who taught at Yale and who was, the two brothers were very, very close. H. Richard Niebuhr tries to get his brother to admit that the whole social gospel project is wrong, that the church just took a wrong move back then, and that Riney needs to overthrow the whole thing in order to start all over again, and that is not going to happen. I mean, Reinhold Niebuhr, the idea of just overthrowing the social gospel is just not in him. It is his career, but his brother does help him to pushes him and prods him to think about how far he has come theologically from the faith that their father preached. He says, for you, religion is just a source of some kind of social ethical idealism, that it does certain kind of justice work in the world. He says, that's liberal. That's a liberal way of thinking about Christianity. He says, you don't even mention Martin Luther or John Calvin anymore. The gospel we heard that shot through with Martin Luther, it's just nowhere evident in your work. And that critique, that's 1932, 1933, that critique, you know, worked on Niebuhr. He realized he had to rethink yet again what his basic theology was. And it takes him the entire 1930s to do that.
And this dovetails off of that, and if you could answer this briefly, because we're getting pretty close to the end of this episode. And I know that when we throw labels on people, or even when people throw labels on themselves, it's very limited. But in this conversation about liberal and conservative and this and that, he was described as neo-Orthodox. I have no idea what that means. Help me.
Well, yes, this we might need to hold this for the next the next segment, because there is just so much. I mean, this has to do with the whole history of 20th century theology and Karl Barth and all of that. To just go for it as briefly as possible, Niebuhr wrote a book in 1935 called An Interpretation of Christian Ethics, and there is a kind of binary in it. He says people who are, conservative theologically, they take the myths that are in the Bible literally. And then people who are theologically liberal, liberal Christians, as soon as they see something that's mythical in the Bible, they just throw it out. And they end up substituting some modern myth of progress or whatever, some end, for the scriptural teaching. And his third way between orthodox overbelief and liberals who don't believe nearly enough is to say we need to take the myths that are in Scripture seriously, but not literally, right? And that's as good, that's certainly on Niebuhr's terms, That's as good as any kind of window on how he sort of proceeds and trying to find some third way between so much of the church that's just that claims to believe things that are in fact unbelievable, and then a liberal Protestantism that's much too willing to just throw it all out in order to reduce it to something much less than true faith.
Gary, I think you did a marvelous job of encapsulating that in just a couple of minutes. No worries there. Now, you are at Union Theological Seminary. How is Niebuhr treated today? Can you possibly get a degree there without being an expert in Reinhold Niebuhr?
Oh, sure. That happens all the time. Niebuhr has never really gone away. He died in 71, and probably his steepest fall within the field occurred right around that time, because we had the advent of liberation theology, and he had just been riding so high anyway for so long in the field that to be in social ethics meant that you were dealing with Niebuhr one way or another. So there was certainly a fall off for some time afterwards, but there have been various Niebuhr revivals ever since, and you just can't be in this field, tell its story, deal with dominant theories and methods and the like without just confronting him all the time, because he was by far the dominant figure in this story. And then, I wrote this big book on the history of social ethics a few years ago, and a number of the folks who are in it, weren't necessarily social ethicists. They're people like Walter Rauschenbusch or Martin Luther King. I mean, they're people who made enormous contributions. They're not necessarily teaching social ethics, but Niebuhr made enormous contributions, and he's actually sitting in, the chair of it at Union Seminary. So there's never been a time when he just went away. And then, of course, there have been various revivals, Niebuhr revivals, over the years. We had a big one after the United States invaded Iraq, and we suddenly had all these political science guys saying, oh, we need a revival of Niebuhrian realism, right? And Niebuhrian realism would not have invaded Iraq.
And we can talk about the revival that you believe might be coming next week, Gary, because this is a great conversation, and I appreciate your presence today. So I want to thank you, and I want to mention briefly that we've been talking to Reverend Gary Dorian from Union Theological Seminary about his essay, Irony Repeats Itself, Reconsidering Reinhold Niebuhr in the Trump Era.